Is Mick up yet? No?
No.
How about Keith? Fuck! How are we going to put this goddamn thing together? Just go put his hands on the guitar.
That's right. We'll tell him he played.
This is the Epic New Podcast. Two idiots and a list. Where you're going to get two idiots and a list. And now, coming to you live from Circle Avenue Studios, your hosts, Nick Fasolo and Kyrick McMillan.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Two Idiots and a List, broadcasting at you from the Circle Avenue Studios on a rainy Friday afternoon. Hey, before we begin, quick shout out to those Redditors who called me on an error during the Doors podcast. This is not a scripted podcast, folks. We are looking at some notes, but they were correct. The Doors had 6 studio albums, not 5. My apologies. My apologies.
for the record, as soon as you said 5 albums, I'm like, it was 6, man. Goddamn Redditors fucking all over it.
Ooh, they got far up my rear end. So,
well, before we get started, also, we're looking at the data coming in from our podcast host, and we again want to shout out to everybody. Like, we have over 1,500 listens and 9 podcasts,
yep,
and like something like 40 different countries and 37 different states and like smallest towns. You know, we really, really appreciate all the support and it's really cool.
It's been a lot of fun.
The weather today is, they must have knew what we were doing today, because the band today is very much like the weather outside. It's dreary, it's dark, it's rainy. They're a seminal band from Seattle. We, of course, are talking about Alice in Chains.
This band for me was a really, really, I don't know if I'd say, I guess I could call it important. It was an important band for me in college.
Yes.
When I was in the mood to get into kind of trippy music, I would listen to the Doors. And when I was feeling a little more aggressive about life or whatever else was going on, Alice in Chains fit that bill to a T.
Perfectly. And it hit us at the exact right moment in our lives, right? 21, 22, 23, in college.
Yep.
You know, going through all different types. The world sometimes turned upside down for us. And I noticed at the same thing. I was like, this is on the same time as the Doors. Like, my whole Doors phase and, like, Dirt and Jar of Flies, and they all came at the same time. And I remember, like, that was the balance. Like, either the Doors or it was Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
It was a weird dichotomy, for sure.
I mean, Nirvana and Pearl Jam carried the day carried the banner for most of that time. But for our group and for us, and I know you were at college in a different area, but, you know, you were also around a lot. Alice in Chains was like,
yeah,
what we listened to.
Oh, like, yeah.
All, you know, the time.
Pearl Jam's 10 was a big deal for everybody. And it was a big deal for me, too. But for me, Dirt by Alice in Chains eclipsed 10 by far. Mm-hmm. I really dug into that album in a huge way. And it had a big effect on my musical tastes. It was easily the heaviest band I've ever listened to in real earnest.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So our childhood friend Tony, he's the first guy that I remember having Alice in Chains. And I remember being in his basement and picking up Facelift. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Because he also had in his collection, like, Danzig and other things like that. And
he had a sparkling collection of music.
He's like, they're really good. You should listen to them. And by that time, I had been done taking my musical requests from Tony. But, like, he was on Facelift early. Like, he bought it early.
I remember that.
Right, and I hadn't listened to it. You know, I saw Man in the Box, and I'm like, eh, okay. I get it. It's fun. It looks cool, crunchy. So I didn't come back around to Facelift as a whole album until after Dirt.
Me too. Absolutely. Yeah. And Facelift was certainly a different vibe than Dirt.
Oh, yes.
Facelift was much more of a metal-based album, much more of a metal groove than what Dirt did, which was far more along the lines of the Soundgardens and Nirvanas of the world at that time.
Yeah. And yeah, Ozzy himself has Facelift as one of his top 10 metal albums of all time.
I could see that. Oh, that makes sense. And, you know, those guys toured a lot under that metal umbrella.
Yeah.
I never thought of them as metal. For me, they never sort of checked that box.
No.
Now, as I listened for this, I went, wow, there was a lot of metal in that first album.
And it's...
I wasn't a big metal guy.
I'm not a metal guy either. I think the metal I go is Metallica.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, I don't even fuck with Megadeth.
No, and I'm not even that big of a Metallica guy, frankly. I like some of their stuff, but it was never like a go-to for me the way that this band was.
Right. And so the thing that captures me about especially Dirt, and then you go back and listen to Facelift and you go and listen to all of their songs, like the lyrics really wrap you in. And
huge.
Because the lyrics are so descriptive and they're so fucking dark.
Yeah.
To like true metalheads, it's probably not really shocking to them that like you could sing songs about stuff like that. You know, you're talking about bands like, you know, Charred Walls of the Damned and stuff like that. It's like, you know, there is heavier stuff out there for sure. But for me, for us, for people who are not into metal as much, this stuff is like, oh,
it's super fuck. Broody. Super yeah. broody.
It's and not broody, Pearl Jam.
Broody kind of downplays the subject matter of especially Dirt, but a lot of their stuff. It's orbiting around addiction with what happened to Layne Staley and mm-hmm. his ultimate demise. Tragic story, really tragic.
And Mike Starr.
And the whole band was
surrounded by it.
They were on it too. Cantrell has spoken multiple times yeah. about his substance abuse.
The themes of their albums are very clear.
Yes.
When you look at, like, when you listen to Facelift is, I'm an addict. And here's why, right? And you then listen to Sap, which was their four-song EP. We'll mm-hmm. come back around to this, but Sap is like, I'm an addict, and here's what it's done to my relationships. Here's the cost
right.
of being an addict.
Right.
And Dirt is like,
I'm an addict, and I don't want to be an addict.
Right. I'm an addict.
That's everything that I drew out of that album is, this is killing me.
Exactly.
It's killing me physically, and it's killing me emotionally.
It's like, you have it exactly. That's almost what I have written down here. It's like, I'm an addict, and this is not going the way I planned.
No.
At all.
No.
And then the last one, Jar of Flies, is like, I'm an addict, and it's all my fault.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's a bummer to listen to that. It's like, and it's total isolation.
Yes.
And that's, unfortunately, that's the way, you know, he went down that path.
And in one of Staley's interviews, Layne Staley was the lead vocalist who was heavily, heavily addicted. In one of his interviews, shortly before he died, he was describing his life and he said, I'm in constant pain. I want to be done with this. I so wish I didn't have this in my life. And then he described fans coming up to him while he was on stage during shows, and they would tap their forearm right. where you would inject yourself, and then they would point at themselves and indicate to him that they too were on the drug.
Yeah.
And he said it crushed him because the last thing he wanted to do was romanticize
yeah.
heroin. And it's kind of what he did. Intentionally or not, there was something about this music that you can't make heroin look sexy, but to a 20-something-year-old that's listening to this pain and they're in some sort of pain themselves, uh-huh. it does sort of bring you around to just a very different look at things. And I think he had some unintended consequences with this.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before, of being, you know, in your 20s and having that indestructible and fuck you attitude.
Yep,
and
bulletproof.
Also, you know, dealing with like adult kind of pressures and issues. And, you know, and when you're in college, you do a lot of self-medicating too.
Sure.
And then this album comes along and you're like, you don't get the backstory.
No.
Like, you don't understand like his day-to-day life, you know, as we can look at it now. And, you know, back in 91 or 92, when we were listening to this stuff, it's not like, you know, we would scour through like his interviews. Like, we just liked his music
sure.
because it, you know, as any good music or music that means something to you, it's like, it speaks to you at some level. It speaks to you. And like, that's all you need for now.
Right.
Like, for right now, that's all I need. I mean, some of my fondest memories of this album, especially Dirt, being up at Northern and getting absolutely shithoused on my own couch, just playing Nintendo, listening to this. You know, it was this facelift. You know, Nine Inch Nails Broken. Right. You know, all ten. Of those on 10 yeah. and like Temple of Never Dog mind. in the 5 CD changer, and just playing Sid Meier's Pirates on Nintendo, and just getting totally housed on my couch.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, look back and I'm like, well, there's probably better things you could have done with your time, but what else are you supposed to do?
Right. One of my oddly strong memories of this album is your brother. I had taken a year off of school because I needed to take a year off from school, and I would come up and knock around with you guys on the weekend. And, you know, he'd come pick me up and we'd drive up to Northern. And I remember listening to this album because it was about 40, 45 minutes from, you know, where we live to Northern. Northern Illinois University, for those of you who are wondering what the hell we're talking about. Right. And we'd roll on up there and listen to that album the whole way. And we'd arrive ready to rock and roll. So yeah, it's tough music. It's super heavy. It's not something that I really listen to now anymore. This is not where I'm at in my musical tastes, but boy,
or in your life
or in my life. You know? I don't have that kind of angst or anger or instability. And
I don't know if you had this experience. I was listening to this and I was like, I'd have to put it down and come back to it. And I was like, oh man, okay. I mean, yeah, it flooded back the memories, right? And I reflect on all that. I'm like, wow, what a different person I was back in college.
Yes.
And like where I am now, it's like, this is still great. And these guys are great artists, but I would not seek this stuff out now. I just can't.
No,
it's so heavy.
It's such a burden to carry.
It's so heavy.
This would have been something like you went from faithfully drinking your sorrows away, and then you got pissed off at it, and then you started listening to Alice in Chains.
This is not like lake music.
No. Let's go float around in the pontoon and listen to some Alice.
Scary. It's like, what the fuck are we listening to? So the flood of music that we enjoyed, we got really super lucky. We're not even talking about like the 80s, which is all like really stuff that people go back to and listen. It's like this 89 to 93?
94, 93,
holy
shit. It's a big snapshot of music.
So this is 1992. Just as like all the like maybe 10 albums I picked out. And I didn't even realize this. 1992, No Doubt, their debut album came out.
I didn't realize they were that old.
I know, right? They were part of that whole scene. I'm not into ska though.
I thought they did a pretty good job. They had some good stuff.
For poppy. That was in March. And then you also have Arrested Development came out with their stuff. Adrenalize, of course, dropped at the end of March. We all need that. L7 came out with their third album, I want to say, but
Pretend That,
was
that We're
the,
Dead.
The Bricks Are Heavy album with Pretend That We're Dead. Yeah, those are cool. They were good. Check Your Head, The Beastie Boys, INXS's Welcome to Wherever You Are. The Wallflowers also dropped their debut album.
Jacob Dylan.
Yeah.
Right? Bob Dylan's son.
I had them placed like much further down in the
90s. I did too.
Black Crowes' second album, it's the Southern Harmony.
Right.
Awesome. I love that album. And two of my most favorite albums from this era, Faith No More's second one, Angel Dust.
Very good album.
And Sugar's Copper Blue.
Oh, I like that album too.
That album.
Bob Mould's great live.
That album fucks. Yeah, we saw him come in the other time. And then you had in September alone, you've got Sugar, Copper Blue, Nine Inch Nails Broken, Stone Temple Pilots Core, Alice in Chains Dirt. And then in November, Rage Against the Machine comes out with their debut album. And then The Verve.
There was a lot happening.
That's a lot. And we haven't even gotten to 1991, which we'll do in another pod, but that's a ton. That's like a bulldozer full of awesome music just shoved in your face.
Right, right. All right, well, let's begin to peel the layers here.
Let's do this.
I think that kicks us off with our honorable mention. I guess I'll start this time. And for my honorable mention, I'm going to go back to that facelift album. And the debut the debut off that album, the first song, is a song called We Die Young. Mm-hmm. This is a 2.5 minute power song, and this is metal. This is much more metal than it is grunge.
Yeah.
It's about as basic a song as you can get. It's repeating power chords, but they really drive it. Staley's vocals are just crisp on this. They really have that great wail. And then Cantrell sings the counter vocals during the verses, and some of the lyrics are tough. You know, bullet seeks the place to bend you over. Cantrell wrote this song after he was riding on a city bus, and he saw kids around the age of 9 or 10 standing on the streets dealing drugs. And
right.
He said the sight of a 10-year-old kid with a beeper and a cell phone dealing drugs equaled We Die Young. Mm. And so he wrote the song.
Mm. Yeah, Cantrell, his vocals are really good, and it's missed on a lot of... You know, well, it was missed on me that he was also a vocalist, because Slane Staley's like razor blade, you know, sound would cut through all of it. But you would always hear this tone of a different voice underneath there. I always thought they were kind of doubling Staley's voice. And then, you know, you come to find out that it's Cantrell.
Right.
And then when they're minus Staley and he picks it up, after, you know, Staley dies. He's a great vocalist.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a great voice.
It's one of the aspects for this band of why they rank so highly for me. Mm-hmm. The paired vocals between Staley and Cantrell, and then even after Staley died and they picked up William Duvall, who was a fantastic replacement
great.
For Lane Staley. Their harmonies are really well written, and they're mm-hmm. incredibly haunting.
Tough to do.
You know, it's just something that is so unique to Alice in Chains.
Look at the lyrics of every one of his songs, whether it's Cantrell writing them or Staley writing them, because those are the only ones
sure.
that wrote the lyrics. They don't mince words.
No.
They don't mince words at all.
They drive come
it right,
home.
They come right out for you.
And that's really one of the other acts. I got three aspects here of why this band ranks so well, and that's the second one, are the lyrics are incredible. You're never sure if Lane Staley is going to live through the song.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
You just
really is.
You don't know what's going to happen. And it's just so, so good.
I think that hits it right there. Because I've always been trying to put a finger on like why. It's like that's it right there. You're not really sure if this fucker is going to make it through the song.
Right.
Because he's so strained, so exhausted, yeah. so tortured, so all of these things like, ugh.
He's been put through a meat grinder by this
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And then the third aspect of them that I like is that the power chords don't just feel like noise. They drive the songs, but they don't crush them.
Mm-hmm.
They the vocals are higher up in the mix, and they really are the centerpiece of what the songs are doing. And the guitar work is just kind of laying this foundation below them. And they are basic, simple power chords, but mm-hmm. they really drive the music in a direction that works.
Yeah, better than like metal to me has always been like I said, Metallica for me is about as metal as I get. Metallica is very fast power chords. That's their music. That's their style, and it's good for them. This is not that.
No,
this is not that. This is like implored, like what you say, driving like
right.
hammers. Pounding a nail.
Right. And Staley's vocals are near operatic, if you could mm-hmm. if you could call an opera singer, you know, with that level of voice.
Yeah.
Right. What you got for your honorable mention?
So my honorable mention reaches to a solo project that Staley did after they were pretty much done. They were in between Jar of Flies and Alice in Chains, and he hooked up with Mike McCready from Pearl Jam, and I want to say the drummer from Screaming Trees.
That's correct.
And they put out one album, Mad Season was the band's name, in 1995. The River of Deceit is my honorable mention.
I could either burn or cut off my pride and buy some time. Full of lies is the weight tied to my waist. The river of deceit pulls down. The only direction we flow is down. Down.
I love that song.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy it. In fact, over the last week, I got a chance to sort of reacquaint with that album, and that album is superb.
Yep.
There's a couple of songs on there that are just dynamite.
The thing about this whole, people ask, so why grunge? And you're getting sick and tired of grunge, and it's so in your face. It's like, there was so much talent. The thing, like, when the single soundtrack came out right before, no, just June of 92, the single soundtrack came out, that kind of blew me away. I was all over the map with that single soundtrack, just put it right in front of me. It's like, here's the roadmap.
Right.
Now go do your research.
Yeah, go sniff around these
go
guys.
Go sniff around, because you haven't heard a band named Mother Love Bone yet.
All right, my number five. I'm going to the album, the first album that they put out with William Duvall as the lead singer. And the song is Check My Brain. When she sang, I answered the call. Oh, yeah. California, fine. Somebody check my brain. California's all right. Somebody check my brain. I don't think these guys could have found a better replacement for Lane Staley than William Duvall.
Yeah, he's great.
His vocal pairing with Cantrell is a perfect match. And they sing in harmony throughout this song, and it really fits so well. He's not trying to duplicate Lane Staley's sound. He's brought his own voice to the band, and it fits just perfectly. And it still has the same grit that Staley had. But it's not like, you know, the Filipino guy doing Journey. Like, this is, he's doing his own thing, and it just, it's so good.
Yeah, and I love the chorus on that. Such a cool kind of, the harmonies with the two voices. It's really a great song. And Duvall, I agree, man. He's like, he's not out there trying to do a Lane Staley impersonation. When he sings those old Alice in Chains songs, there is a difference, but it's not a difference like, oh, that's no good. That's a difference like, oh, that's a different, okay. Yeah, it's still a great song. It still sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. All right, what you got for number five?
I'm off the same album for my number five. I just went, my number five off of that same album was Black Gives Way to Blue.
Curtains drawn, now it's done.
Heavy tune, man.
it's Jerry Cantrell's sort of moody groove on that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. I didn't even know this, but like Elton John plays the keyboards on that.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Right? It's like, that's an odd pairing.
Was he wearing the duck outfit? Because that would have been awesome.
It's a compilation of that and Crocodile Rock.
Yeah. Da, 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 da.
I remember when black was blue. Hey, if anybody would pull it off, Elton John can pull
it off. I agree. All right. That brings me to my number four, which is Damn That River.
The reason why Cantrell wrote this song is because him and Sean Kinney,
the drummer,
had a fight, and Sean Kinney broke a coffee table over his head. And he put him in a, like, and then somebody came in and put Cantrell into a different room to calm him down and keep him from killing each other. And he wrote that song.
He wrote the song then.
So the snake that I would trample is Sean Kinney.
Sean Kinney. I like this song. You know, this is a song that if you're in a mood to get a little hostility out, this will do it, especially with the stereo jacked to 11.
Yeah.
It's quick. It only lasts about 3 minutes. Opens with the guitar and bass running the same lines in unison, which always works for me. Any song I hear that in, for some reason, I'm like, ooh, there's something about that groove that really works.
This is the song that introduced me to drop D tuning in guitar playing. You take the low E string, which is the lowest sounding one, and you drop it down a tone to D.
Right.
And so then it becomes basically, in effect, your bass string.
Right.
So when you double it with a bass running the same line, it gives you a lot of testosterone.
Oh, yeah. It really moves. And I'm a big fan of Jerry Cantrell's guitar solo in this, especially with what the drums and the bass are doing in the background. I just think it really works.
Yeah. It's an adrenaline rush.
Yes.
Like, it's like straight. And I think that's kind of like he alluded to. It's like we structured this album to be kind of that. It's an adrenaline rush. And in the middle, it's like, I'm fucked.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it's, I can't get out.
Yeah. So it's a strike to the heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. What you got for number four?
Number four, I'm going to Facelift. I Can't Remember. Keep it all in till you die. The story that this tells is just, it starts out like, just he's telling you his biography. This is a biographical story in my mind. And, you know, the theme of the song is like, I can't remember why I'm doing this, but here you go. This is what I do. This is what I'm up to.
This is what's happening with me.
Yeah. And this is not the song, but I don't know if it's going to come up, but like it's around the same song selection of Facelift in here. There's a one song, Bleed the Freak. Is that on your list?
No.
Okay.
But it was swimming in the shallow waters for it.
They are. The line, I'll pluck out thine eye, always got me.
Yes.
And it was such a funny line.
It's
like, I'll pluck out thine eye. Run slower, let the arrow fly. When the sea lies bolder, I'll pluck out thine eye. Name your god and bleed the freak. I'd like to say,
there's a couple of lyrical nuggets in their catalog that are just superb.
But you mentioned it. It's like of all the songs been surrounding us, it's like Facelift, Sap, Dirt, and Jar of Flies, nearly batting 1,000.
Yes, yes. There's one or two that we'll probably bring up you know, kind of knock them off the perfect album pedestal. But I agree, there are just out of those catalogs, you have batted 999,
which is a pretty damn good average. Fucking great.
Yeah.
Anyhow, go ahead.
My number three, I loved Jar of Flies. That was their EP release after the album Dirt. Mm-hmm. The whole, the zig when everyone else zags Rush fan in me, as you've so duly noted in a previous episode, hates to do this since there are so many good songs off of this album. But I love the lead single from this EP, which is No Excuses. Laying low. This was a number one hit for them, and maybe because that's the song fit so much more into a grunge category than their previous heavy stuff, I'm not sure. There's something about this song that just speaks to me on a number of levels. During the verses, the drums are playing an almost African rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, he adds a couple of extra tom hits that gives it an almost like a samba feel. Mm-hmm. And Staley and Cantrell sing in unison throughout the entire song, and their harmonies are brilliant.
Perfect.
And we were just talking about lyrics. There's a lyric in here that says, "You, my friend, I will defend. And if we change, well, I'll love you anyway."
Mm-hmm. You, my friend.
I hope everybody has a friendship in their lives where those lyrics mean something, because it's incredibly poignant. Yeah. I mean, it really just strikes through the heart. Amazing, amazing song.
It's the rawest lyrics. We talked about metal lyrics as being like really super heavy, and like you have no idea how dark, you know, these lyrics can go. These are raw, pure raw human emotion that you can touch and feel. Like, yeah. You can put in your like,
it's tactile.
Yeah, I know that there are metal bands out there that are, you know, talking about, you know, stripping flesh from your. Oh, by the way, he does also say, "I want to strip the flesh from your." He does say that.
He wrote the song about Staley.
Yes,
it's Cantrell writing about his relationship with Staley and their friendship and the challenges that existed, and that's why that line is so poignant to me. You know, it's.
Teddy.
Things are going to change, and that doesn't matter. I'm still going to love you. That's an amazing emotion to, you know, to put forth.
Yeah. And then have the guy you're talking about, like, record it. Like,
yeah.
Sing it.
Right,
like,
right.
I don't think it was missed on him either.
They wrote and recorded the whole album in 1 week.
Right. They I remember the story. Didn't they have to fly, like, a string orchestra in? Like, I wanted to say
that. I don't know. I didn't see that.
Yeah, something like that. But anyhow, yeah.
If they said it, you know, it would have taken 6 months to write and get that on tape, I would have believed it, because a week is crazy. None of these guys were clean when that album was cut.
No.
So you've got four heroin addicts writing and recording music in a week. That's crazy.
I mean, it took the Stones like 3 years to get their shit together for a night, and they're all strung out. But I mean, it's like, is Mick up yet? No?
No.
How about Keith? Fuck, how are we going to put this goddamn thing together? Just go put his hands on the guitar.
We'll tell him he played. All right, what you got for number three?
It is The Real Thing. It's a conversation with a junkie, and like, it's a one-sided conversation with a junkie.
A difficult conversation.
Yeah, it's heavy.
Yes.
So, and it's like, but the music that kind of, you know, cloaks that story, it's infectious. It's really like groovy and like, it's tough to talk about.
It is.
You know,
there's something about these guys that draw emotion out of you, especially when you've been living in their catalog for the last week.
I found this really hard to go. I had to put it down and go back to it, and I'm like, man, okay. We were in different mindsets back then.
Yes.
Way different mindsets.
Yeah.
You know, and keep reminding ourselves of that.
Nothing like tearing scabs off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool stuff.
All right, that brings us to our fantasy concert lineup.
Let's do it.
I think I'd like to see these guys with Living Color.
Ooh.
Give me a little Cult of Personality.
That solo on that song.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
How those guys didn't go farther and do more, I don't understand. The rest of that album was okay.
Yeah.
You know, there was a song or two on there that was okay. Like,
yeah.
They wrote an absolute gem with that song.
Yeah.
And then drove the truck off the face of the cliff.
They had the open letter to a landlord.
Yeah, that was a little odd. And then I want to see Audioslave.
Okay.
Show Me How to Live.
Yeah.
I think Cornell, what he did with Audioslave, I think that would really fit well with Alice in Chains. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going for a full day festival.
Ooh.
I want you in early. We're going to see Mother Love Bone.
Nice.
Their only album, but it's a fucking killer album.
T to B.
T to B. And then we're going to switch sets up really quick and bring in Temple of the Dog.
Right.
Do their album, which is another killer album. And then bring on Alice in Chains to do, you know, their first four albums. It's, it'll be a festival.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have to, like, to go to Great America or Disneyland for the next four fucking weeks because...
Drink a lot of water.
You just need a lift. You just need a lift.
All right, that brings us to number two. My number two, I'm going back to dirt. I'm going with wood.
Yeah. I did not realize this. Maybe you'll tell me.
It's about Andrew Wood.
Right.
It's about Andrew Wood, who died from a heroin overdose. Mm. Andrew Wood from Mother Love Bone. They called it Wood. They spelled it differently, but...
Yeah, that's what threw me. So I'm like, And then I'm like, oh, well, shit, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
This song is all in the rhythm section, right? It starts with the bass line. That drives it, and then the drums kick in, and they never really change from the verses to the chorus, and they're just super heavy on the toms, and I like the way it works.
Yeah.
Layered vocals in the verses. Short song, 3.5 minutes. As you said, it was part of the singles soundtrack, which I think it's probably one of the best movie soundtracks out there. I couldn't tell you squat about the film. I think I've seen it probably twice. I have no real memory of the movie, but I remember the soundtrack like it was, you know, yesterday.
Yeah. it opened up so many doors for me musically, because I was basically, you know, when Nirvana and Pearl Jam came out in 91, it's like, okay, this is new and I like it. I'm in for it. I love it. And then singles came out and they're like, holy shit, there's a whole universe of this new music out there. And I was still kind of, you know, 1 foot into the hair metal scene, 1 foot into the, you know, the new Seattle sound. And then singles came out and you're like, okay, Smashing Pumpkins is from here.
Right.
Let's go see that.
Right.
Like, that's cool shit.
And you talk about some of the, you know, that song being about Andrew Wood, and I don't think we want to go super deep here, but the grunge opioid legacy is nothing short of astonishing.
Stunning.
Lane Staley, 34. Mike Starr died at 44. That's half of this band.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Wood, Mother Love Bone, died at 24. Mm-hmm. Cobain, 27. Cornell, 52. Weiland, 48. Shannon Hoon of Blind Melon, 28. I mean, just over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult. Yeah. Really hard.
And here's Eddie Vedder sitting in the middle of all mm-hmm. of it, just watching, you know, Eddie Vedder and McCready and Stone and all yeah. those guys from Pearl Jam just sitting around just like, man, that's just a spooky fucking feeling.
It's got to be horrible to watch these terrible, guys that right? were your compatriots go down.
And I think that you see the same kind of thing repeat itself almost in, you know, we were talking earlier about the music of the 60s, late 60s and late 70s. You do have tragic deaths
Absolutely.
Early of your stars,
mm-hmm.
Largely from fucking heroin.
Sure.
Like, you know, and, you know, Hendrix and Janis and Keith. And,
right.
You know, it's like, so you do, that does repeat itself.
Yes.
Here, it just, you know, as I always tell my students, history doesn't repeat itself, but it echoes, right?
I like that. All right, what's your number two?
My number two is Junkhead. I had that
just barely coming up, and I decided to pull it off. I love this song.
I think that's like, because when you listen to it, like, now we're talking about, we did listen to this with a gang of people also. Like, this was one of those albums that you listen to on your own.
Right.
When you're feeling especially edgy. And, or, you know, when it, like, you're at a party at, or, you know, just hanging out with your mates, like, it was also on too. And this song in particular is like, you know, his lyric, you know, we are an elite race of our own, the stoners, the junkies, and the freaks.
Yes.
I'm like, I'm home. I'm home, Papa.
Nothing better than a dealer who's high.
Exactly. And so we are talking about, like, how the unintended consequences of emulating his behavior, and that's nothing he didn't want. Not to say that we were emulating that specific behavior.
No.
But
doing so in other ways.
We're edgy enough.
Sure.
We're getting there.
Yeah, you know, I mean.
And that tune and that whole thing just kind of spoke to me anyhow, and I think that, you know, a lot of us kind of felt the same way.
It's absolutely
like nothing better than a dealer's high.
I
understand what you're talking about.
I think you can apply that to any substance, legal or not.
Yeah for sure.
All right, that brings us to our number one, and I'm curious, did we fall on the same one?
I don't know, there's so many tunes.
There's a lot out there.
But I do want to broach one topic here. I have right here, it's like, let's have a conversation. Should the whole Dirt album go in the Pantheon?
I think you could argue that.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's
for sure.
A special, different album.
It is.
For me, I think for you as well.
I agree.
Just like the end was, you know, for both of us,
right.
Like in the Pantheon. I think Dirt deserves.
The End by the Doors.
Yeah.
I think that's certainly an interesting conversation. What I'd be curious to know is, would our 17-year-old sons, if they were given this album today and played it, what would the impact be on a kid today versus someone that was, and we were a little older than that when this album came out,
yeah.
But what kind of an impact would this album have on them? I have a feeling it probably wouldn't register. I think they're just in a different mindset. I also think there's a different style of music out there that certainly both of our boys are interested in. This may not necessarily fall within that realm.
It might glance off them. If you gave them the lyric sheet, kind of like, say, here, listen to the music and read the lyrics, because to be honest with you, and I'm a lyric kind of guy, like I remember lyrics a lot. And so for whatever reason, like I kind of know, you know, the lyrics, but I don't know them all because I read them and I'm like, well, I don't remember ever singing along yeah. like that with those lyrics.
A couple of them
like,
surprised me too.
I'm like, oh.
What was I singing about?
Okay. All right. So, but if you gave them the lyric sheet, I think they would come away with this understanding. It's like, this guy's fucked up.
Yeah. And he was a hell of a poet.
Yeah.
They were a hell of a poet.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the co-writing here was Cantrell and Staley. Mm-hmm. I think Cantrell carried a lion's share.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the credits over the course of, you know, albums, but Staley's got credits too. And I wasn't always able to find out if, you know, a lyrical credit was necessarily one or the other. Sometimes it was more of a generalized credit. So
I think they would walk away like getting the cautionary tale.
Yeah.
That would be my hope.
I would hope so
that would
too.
Be my hope.
I would hope so too.
That would not be my hope to be like, that's cool. Let's emulate. Like,
right.
We didn't really have that guidance.
No.
But who does?
Right.
You know, who does when you're that age? I think that's kind of like, we've talked about this several times before. The danger of rock and roll is what attracts us.
Sure.
It. And this was
probably really some edgy. Of the most dangerous rock and roll that I ever got into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
All right. My number one.
Go ahead.
Is The Rooster.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Fantastic lyrics. Such a great, great story. I'm not a big pro-military guy in any shape or form, but I have always had a place in my heart for Vietnam veterans, due in large part because I've worked with a fair number of them over the years, and I've heard their stories, and I've seen what they went through. And there's something about this song that draws empathy for anyone who went through that hell in any war. Staley's vocals are almost incomparable in this song to other songs. And that's hard to say for him because, you know, he is so good across so many levels of what they did.
Right top line of the mix.
Yeah.
Right there.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
miss a word.
Front and center. Right. Front and center. And I think they mixed him perfectly. Mm-hmm. Cantrell uses a wah-wah reverb effect on his guitar. And it fits so well, especially in a song that's this heavy.
Yeah.
It's just not something you really hear in this kind of heavy music. A couple other odd facts on this song. It was banned from Clear Channel-owned radio stations after September 11th. They said it was inappropriate.
Perfectly fits for that conservative.
I don't, you're right. Talk about right-wing corporate bullshit.
Perfectly happy to send young men off to war. But when you come back broken,
we don't want to hear about it.
Fuck off.
We don't want to hear about it.
It's probably a product of me not paying attention to the liner notes and, you know, just listening to the song. And I always was under the impression that the rooster was Lane Staley's father. But as it turns out, it's Cantrell's father.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't know that because I didn't bother to do the research.
Right. No, it's about Cantrell's father and it's Cantrell's interpretation of what his father experienced during the Vietnam War. And he didn't talk to his dad about it. His dad didn't talk to him about it. And so Cantrell, it sounded like maybe the home life wasn't a great experience with his dad.
Yeah.
And so he wrote this song as an interpretation of what he believes his father went through. Mm-hmm. And Cantrell played it at a show that his father was at. And it was the only show that his father had seen of theirs. Cantrell gave this quote later. He was back there with his big gray Stetson and his cowboy boots. He's a total Oklahoma man. And at the end, he took his hat off and just held it in the air. And he was crying the whole time. And afterwards, his dad told him, quote, he got too close, that he hit it on the head.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a, in the last verse, the drummer goes into a marching drum snare that I thought was a really, really cool aspect of a song about war.
Subtle.
And just adding this sort of subtle touch
of the
snare drum running like that. Great song.
Yeah, it is. Walking Tall, Machine Gun Man. Ugh. Yeah. Just the man, the lyrics are just great. Ugh.
Yeah, they spit on me in my homeland. Yeah. It's tough.
The illusions that he is able to conjure is really, really that, special.
Especially since he didn't talk to him about it.
Yeah.
It's really something.
Yeah. It's fucked up.
What you got for number one?
My number one is for off the Jar of Flies album, and it is Don't Follow. Through when they break it down, and then he kind of goes into his, like, it's not a rap, but it's kind of like a spoken word.
I have that note here as well. It's the ending where Staley raps the lyrics is it's a really kind of a cool transition that they come out of at the end there.
That's it's always Jet Jar Flies album when it came out. I was like, oh, what the fuck, this all acoustic, you know. It was very much like the Sap EP, and I thought that Ann Hart and Chris Cornell, they might have some of the best backing vocals of all time on those songs. Like just the screaming and her like harmonizing at the higher registers, just great stuff. Like they really put together a 4-album package of music that was, it's just, it's really awesome.
Right.
It really is. It's super heavy though. I just could not like go ahead with your, I think we have another a segment to go along with.
Sure. All right. So that brings us to our most hated. This one might hurt you a little bit. My most hated is Don't Follow.
Oh, no kidding.
All it's that damned harmonica. I can't get past the harmonica.
I could do without the harmonica.
I think it's actually a really good song until they start playing that fucking harmonica. I don't want to be sitting around a campfire in the middle of a mesa listening to this song, and that's what it feels like. It's not even a bluesy harmonica. It's like Cookie got off the chuck wagon and started blowing harp.
It's the Blazing Saddles when they're sitting around the campfire.
Yeah. More beans, Mr. Taggart.
I'd say you had enough. It's the same harmonica, though. Yeah, I kind of almost filter that out through my brain. It's like I'm just paying attention to the guitars and lyrics.
And my note here says it's too bad because it's great towards the end where Staley raps the lyrics. Yeah. You know, well. What do you have for most hated? Funny.
The one I have is Godsmack. I never liked the sound of his voice on this.
Yeah,
and he's like, his voice is almost wiggly. You know, the lyrics are fine. The lyrics are very descriptive, but I just didn't like the way that the lyrics were delivered in that song. And that's really the only criticism I have of it. And I just like, whenever I hear that chunky bass come in and I'm like, oh, this is the one where he fucks with around those lyrics. I skip.
All right. This ended up being the most difficult category for me. I don't think I've had quite as many, and I'm going to have to pare it down, but this is our best 4 seconds category.
So I've got a couple. They're kind of like, they're almost all intros of the songs that I'm like, wow, this, like the intro to Grind.
Yeah.
fucking awesome.
Yes.
I'm not a fan. Like, the song is fine, but I just don't go out of my way to hear that song. But when I skip across it, I'm like, oh, right. The first 30 seconds are fucking killer.
Yeah.
The whole song is really good. It really is. But it takes a long time to get there. And it's like, anyhow. I love that.
All right. What else you got?
The opening to Rotten Apple.
I had that as well.
Right. Inez's big, heavy bass, acoustic bass.
Yes.
Such a cool sound.
Yeah.
And he's just twerking that off of the bass guitar. Really cool.
Yeah. I had that as well. And I've managed to pare down my list here a little bit so we don't extend this into an hour and a half.
Right. And my last one is the open for I Stay Away. Simple D chord and it's arpeggiated and it just keeps on doing the run. It's really, it's great. I'm not a fan of the breakdown they do after the first chorus, but yep. It's a small minor detail.
No, that, I'm with you. I had the chorus in again. I bet it really eats you up.
Leads into these heavy riffs in the doot-doot and falsetto. Mm-hmm. I really like that chorus. I also have the love, hate, love vocals right before he sings love, hate, love.
The end of the yes. song where he just breaks down.
Just butts out into it. Yeah!
He screams love, hate, love for yes. like 45 seconds.
Yeah. And then off of Facelift, I can't remember, he hits these crazy high falsettos.
Yeah.
They're great. And they also he also has one of my other favorite lines in there, not from its poignancy, but excuse the tood, but I haven't eaten in days. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I'm sure it has to do with I haven't eaten in days because of my addiction. Yeah, so it's probably
my eyes are turning gray.
Yeah, it's not a happy song.
What's the blame?
Excuse the tood. I think that's just well written.
Yeah.
All right, who's your MVP here?
Oh man, Jesus. You know, and I don't want to give it to heroin, but like without heroin, you don't have any of this shit. You don't have this whole fucking section of music.
I think that's incredibly appropriate, as inappropriate as it may seem.
We're not giving the MVP to heroin. It's just that without heroin's existence and the devastation that it causes and the way that it rips people apart and fucks everything up, the artists find a way to make something out of it while they're here.
No, I'm in agreement. And, you know, you can argue Staley and Cantrell
are the conduits for that. But really, it was heroin that created this mood, that created this situation that they're in. All right, I'm not going to ask you the Steve Perry question this time because I don't think it's possible to slap myself hard enough.
It's not appropriate.
So we'll skip the is Steve Perry better than Layne Staley?
Can we tell the Alice in Chains story, the live show story?
Sure.
Our good friend, we already talked about him, Tony, ran the scam of all scams.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You would never be able to pull this shit off.
No.
Not today.
No.
Not with the internet, not with it.
I don't know how you pulled it off back then.
Balls.
Brass.
Him and his cousin got this idea in their head. It's like, well, if we could make up like we're our own PR firm and we have a magazine, a rock magazine, and all we have to do is contact their PR people, maybe we can, you know, get something going. Because those tickets still at that time, they were hard to get.
Sometimes
when Pearl Jam would come around, they're fucking hard to get.
Yeah.
You know, so he did it. He created a magazine that never got published to my knowledge, never fucking even printed a page, but he had, you know, a masthead and fucking letterheads that he would type up these. We understand that, you know, one of your clients, Alice in Chains, is in town and, you know, here's our magazine's name. These are our reporters and photographers. Can we get access to your band?
And they got it.
They fucking got it. Like, now, Tony has always been like, you know, the kid is like, oh, no, we're going to go to the Van Halen show. We're going. The 51-50 tour, we're going. We have backstage passes. And by that time, like, throughout high school, I'm like, all right, okay, all right. So I went to college with him, but we were, you know, across campus. We rarely saw each other. But I would keep in touch with him. And he's like, yeah, man, I'm doing this thing. I got photo press passes for the Alice in Chains show. And I'm like, oh. That's great. It's same thing with the backstage pass for 5150, right? And he's like, yeah, no, I'll look for you. I'm like, you do that. You look for me. So at the end of the show, as the ballroom is clearing out, I'm like, is this motherfucker here? And in front of the stage, there is like a roped off section for press. And there's fucking Tony sitting there with his mom's it's flash cube camera.
Instamatic camera.
And he's inside the fucking ropes. And I make a beeline to him. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing here? And he's like, I told you I had press passes. And he swang the press pass in front of me. Alice in Chains, Dirt Tour, press. And then it has a sticker that says photo. Like, what the fuck?
It's the scam of a century.
He has the most unbelievable pictures of that time. He's got a picture of Eddie Vedder where he is sitting at Eddie's feet. Eddie is on the stage and he's got the picture going straight up Eddie's mic stand. It's unreal.
Yeah.
The Layne Staley picture he has is like his face was through the fucking cargo net. It's like in your face. It's like, what? You'd sell those to Rolling Stone. You'd get paid a fortune for them. There were great shots off these shitty flash cube fucking camera.
Well, we'll see if he can't get us some of those. We can maybe throw those up on some of our social media.
Unbelievable. Here's the other crazy thing. They contacted Rage Against the Machine. Now, Rage Against the Machine hadn't popped off yet, but they knew that Tom Morello was from this area. So they contacted Rage's people, and they said, well, he's getting ready to set for this new tour, for the new album they're about to drop, but his mom is available. And he's like, fuck it, let's interview the mom. And they're like,
and they did.
They fucking went to her house. I believe she lived in Lombard at the time. She had him over.
She made him dinner.
Made him dinner, sitting out in the driveway, talking about what, you know, what a groovy cat Tom is, and she's groovy herself. And they do this whole fucking interview. And I'm like, what? What? You interviewed Tom Morello's mom?
Why are there two 18-year-olds sitting in my mom's kitchen with an Instamatic camera?
They ran this scam for, I want to say, like 12 months. And they got incredible access. And of course, didn't have to pay for it.
Nope. Just, nothing like free concerts in the front row. All right. That brings us to our rankings. Oh, actually, hold on. I missed one. Sisters of Mercy. Do you want more?
No. I can't handle it. Just too much for me.
You know what? I dug into some more of the Mad Season, and I dropped a few of those on my playlist. All right, let's go to our rankings.
Okay. For catalog, these guys, like we mentioned it before, these guys were batting nearly 1,000 on their stuff. So I gave them a 4 for their catalog.
I had them at a 4 as well for the exact same reason. You know, they went from metal like Facelift to heavy grunge like Dirt. And then they drop into a groove grunge like Jar of Flies. Mm-hmm. And all that acoustic versatility is fantastic. The AIC album, the self-titled album, no. And Unplugged, I hate anything Unplugged. I don't know why. Yeah. It just rubs me in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it's like their greatest hits album. You know,
yeah, really just and a bad one.
Yeah. Their artistry I have at a 3.5, 3.5. Their lyrics are great art. It's good. It's better than most, above average.
I had them at 3.8. Staley and Cantrell are really, really talented. The bass and drums are pretty average. Like you can plug and play just about anybody into those, but Cantrell's writing and his guitar and Staley's lyrics, fantastic.
Yeah, for sure.
Image.
Yeah, Image was tough, man. Is this a cool band? Man, I don't know.
I dropped these guys, and I had the same wrestling match with this, and I had to look at it from the image that I had of them, and that's what I ended up doing, was looking at them as what their image was to me back in that day.
Okay.
And I put them at a 4.2. I thought these guys were the shit.
Yes.
And
I agree with that. So I'm going to go with that.
Yeah.
Because I have them at a 3. But I'm at a 48-year-old man.
Yeah.
There are 3. They're really good. They're really, but are they cool? No, not to a 48-year-old man. To a 20-year-old young man.
Yeah.
Like, as you said, they're the shit.
Yeah. I agree. You know, the scores
we didn't know how it was going to end.
Right.
Them.
Right. Right.
And so,
so many others.
Right. Exactly. We thought like, ooh, that's close. Get the flame as close as you can to your face. Ooh, that's cool. I like that. Okay. Yeah. Take me even closer. And then we didn't know how it was going to fucking end.
Right.
And it did.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely 2 different scores there. Today's perspective and back then. All right, that wraps it up for this episode of Alice in Chains. This episode of Two Idiots in a List. Thanks for listening. We'll come back at you here soon with another one.